Let's get him on then. Ex-BBC journalist, terrific broadcaster, Bristol, thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show every Friday. It's always a pleasure to welcome back to the programme the one and only Tony Gosling. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Tony?
Fine. Hi.
Thanks for being there. I think it's a story worth looking into. A number of candidates who threw their hats into various rings around the country, be it local authority elections, be it regional mayoral elections, obviously all of this taking place on Thursday, a number of anti-lockdown and vaccine safety candidates have had their Twitter accounts deleted. Some of them have had it happen to them since they paid their deposit and got their names on the ballot. Twitter doing that. That's election interference, if ever there was election interference, right?
Well, of course it is. And it shows you that the Bilderberg social media companies, we're talking about the Facebooks, the LinkedIns, these people, the Googles, etc., are just doing what the mass media has been doing. Yeah, so they just, you know, once they herd everybody off the mass media because of the infantile, you know, celebrity gossip lies that they tell, everyone's herded onto the social media, the commercial social media, and then they start doing exactly what the previous lot did.
The current digital culture and media secretary is a guy called Oliver Dowden. I know that some of these people who've been banned and deleted have written to him to ask him to look into it. But if they're going to hold their breath, they're going to run out of air, aren't they? I mean, no government is going to take them on.
That's not the point. The point is it's too late. Yeah, if these people wanted to get their stuff out on social media
to
win an election, the election's gone.
Yeah.
So it's a slam dunk. I mean, the media is, you know, in so many ways, is in the middle of all the trouble, you know. So they are, you know, well, as I've said many times, these people are the nerve system of humanity, the media, the press. And it's how we, you know, keep ourselves going and repair damage in society, things like that. You know, the idea that when the courts fail us, that the last court of appeal is your world in action or whatever, you know. So it's a key site of struggle, and if you can't get stuff out on the media, I mean, for example, if you cannot pick up the phone, as people can with you, Richie, and just say what you want to say, something you're concerned about, and get it out to the nation. You know, you can't do that in China, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the big difference.
It's ironic on a day that the UK government is accusing Iran, bizarrely, of attempting to interfere in the Scottish election on Thursday.
Oh, what a joke.
Oh, that's outrageously... But are people believing this? Is the average man or woman who's reading the Telegraph going to work, if they're still going to work, or who's watching it on Sky News this morning, are they actually buying this nonsense, do you think?
I think a lot of people do, because they are not aware the extent to which the press over the last 30 or 40 years has been twisted and is being used to manipulate them. So the thing is, people, that's one of the things, I may have told you this story before, but we had a phone-in when I was working for the BBC in Southampton, and it was a very popular phone-in. And this morning, something to do with the very first Gulf War, and there was a load of people from Portsmouth who'd been, involved, or families involved with servicemen that were going off to, and the phone-in lines opened up, and there was no lights on the phone desk. So I was thinking, I said to them, turn to the producer, I said, what's going on? No one's phoning in. Normally it was a very popular. And she said, well, we haven't told them what to think yet. And it was, she had a smile. She was actually a really lovely woman.
Yeah.
And, so she, cause she realized she hadn't really done her job properly. And she typed out very quickly a script as the first record was going out. And I whipped it through to the presenter, and, the presenter started reading it just after that, and you could see literally by the time she got to the bottom of the sheet of paper, the phone lines were going, because there were all sorts of concerns that people might have. You know, have they ever visited that part of the world?
Yeah.
You know, would it be that you might be going to somewhere in the Middle East on holiday rather than to war? You know, all these sorts of things to prompt people's thinking. And this is the thing with the mass media particularly, is you don't know what you don't know, and they're censoring it. They're censoring it massively. All this stuff to do with ivermectin, you know, for example, this antiviral, which is, you know, it's not a magic bullet, but it can save your life. And, you know, there's a lot of doctors who are getting extremely upset that they're being ignored and not listened to, and want to prescribe it and are stopped from prescribing it. And not only that, loads of the content that they're putting up online is just being deleted by the Googles. It's not being deleted by most ordinary internet service providers, etc., by the big guys. The guys that have decided that they are taking over from the traditional mass media. You know, we're talking here about, you know, the obvious, you know, Twitters, Facebooks, etc., been getting really strict about this. And they're trying to make out that we are killing people by talking about these antiviral drugs, which don't care about whether something's a new variant or not. Yeah. They'll help save your life, whatever variant it is. But the thing is, they're not vaccines. And this whole agenda is all about, you know, trying to get everybody, you know, another regime of vaccines. I also think this whole business of having two vaccines is very important. I don't think it's medically necessary to have two vaccines, but millions of people are having two, well, probably billions of people are having two vaccines because it gets you into the habit of, oh, one is not enough. You're going to have another one and another one and another one. And this is about an income stream. It's not about people's health.
No, it isn't. We'll come back to that in a moment, actually, because that's very important, particularly talk about vaccinating every child in the country, which is untenable. It's unconscionable, really. Children are not affected by whatever coronavirus is or was. We'll come back to that in a moment. I know you've been talking on social media about London last week, where several hundred thousand people at least came out. You must have laughed on Sunday. I'm up here in Salford. I'm literally, I smack people who say literally. I'm only around the corner from Old Trafford Football Stadium. I can walk to it in 15 to 20 minutes. And you have a few thousand United fans up in arms about the ownership of the club. That's fair enough. And all of that, you mightn't approve of guys bursting in and getting on the pitch. But blanket coverage from Sky and the BBC. Blanket. Not a dicky bird about what was going on in London, Tony.
Well, I think both are important stories, actually. It may be that the one was orchestrated to blot out the other. Who knows? As an excuse, anyway, to blot out the other. These sort of things, you know, this whole business about good days to bury bad news. Of course, that the opposite can be true. You know, stuff can be made to happen on certain days that will mean that something else won't get so much coverage it was otherwise have done. They're both important stories. They both should be covered. There is enough room on a bulletin to cover both.
Oh, yeah.
Look. You know, it's really important, obviously, that the ownership of these football clubs is challenged when the owners are obviously not working, not only in the fans' interests or the players' interests, they're not working in the city that is its interests, they're not even working in the national interest, that they are just another arm of a kind of globalist menace which is out there. I mean, I've been looking at all these local elections, loads and loads of these mayors, etc., which are being elected by people don't realise what they're voting for. Most of the mayor candidates that are out there are pro-globalist, so they're into the idea of having each city as not really interested in central government, but linking up with other cities around the world, bringing in businesses from abroad. Not about supporting local businesses, and if people knew that, they quite possibly wouldn't be voting for these mayors. So there's a globalist agenda out there on lots of different levels, and a lot of the times I think people are, you know, not aware it's even taking place. I mean, for example, we had a business meeting recently in Bristol, and there's, you know, the local businesses weren't invited, but they're inviting and paying for, they're paying for all the food and everything for them from all over Europe. Now, this is actually a Remainiac agenda being paid for with public money.
With public money. We're already 25 minutes to 6 o'clock. We've got, in the interest of absolute fairness and balance, I'm going to give a lot of time to Piers Corbyn in the second hour because I gave a lot of time to David Curtin last Thursday. And time flies, so I want to jump around a few issues with you. Before we come back to vaccines, do you believe, as I do, that this net zero carbon agenda is connected to the agenda to vaccinate every man, woman and child in the country?
Well, I don't know, but the zero carbon thing is absolute nonsense, I think. The idea that you cannot put any carbon into the atmosphere. Look, we're made of carbon. All this stuff about, you know, when I very first saw this stuff about cow farts, right, making a great big, you know, I knew straight away, looking at that, it was total rubbish.
Bollocks, yeah.
But the thing is, people pick up on it and people take it seriously and, oh, you're a terrible person if you question it. But this, I think, is a way of actually actually sorting out people who are compliant and pliable to their agenda. So anyone that sort of laughs at it and ridicules it will be noted down, you know?
Yeah.
And made sure that they don't get the funding, whatever. And I think this is what's happened. I mean, I stood as a Green councillor years ago in Bristol. I'm an environmentalist. I think that creation is a wonderful thing, needs to be looked after, you know, et cetera. I don't like pollution, all these sorts of things. But I've seen the green agenda absolutely hijacked by these people. You know, the idea of zero carbon.
When did that happen to you?
Coming from?
This is very important now because you're speaking from great experience. When did it happen? When did the green agenda? Because when I started in commercial radio as a producer, I started as a presenter first of music, then I went on to news and current affairs like yourself, and I used to meet Greens, and I could name some of these people in Ireland. They were lovely people. They weren't insane. They weren't talking about decarbonising the economy. When, the entire country, the entire planet, when did it happen? When did it change, as far as you can tell?
Okay, so it was gradual, but there are some very big milestones in that. One of them was Fukushima. And when that happened, there was an absolute reaction in the environmental movement against everything nuclear. And at the same time, an old friend of mine, George Monbiot, who was by then a Guardian columnist, he wrote a column about Fukushima defending nuclear power and attacking Chris Busby, who you and I have interviewed many times,
yeah.
And he's actually now left Britain. He's, you know, had enough of the place because he's been harassed by the police, etc. Now, Chris did an amazing job over the years in exposing how both the industry and the government were working together to cover up cancer deaths and cancer clusters around nuclear power stations because they were trying to say, well, nuclear power is not dangerous. You know, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. The nuclear bomb stuff, well, that is, you know, a little bit, we've got to be very careful with that. But it was a lie, and Chris exposed that. And this was after Fukushima. The Germans stopped their entire nuclear program, and Britain was potentially going to follow suit. You know, we're saying, well, look, this is actually incredibly expensive, and we're not, you know, and it's not green. But anyway, George then did a whole diatribe about, first of all, how Chris Busby was he did a hatchet job on the guy, which is one of the most horrific pieces of journalism I've ever seen, because Chris really was a man of the people doing a fantastic job for the environmental movement and saving people's lives by explaining to them what was going on with the power stations. So that whole business made me absolutely sick. And of course, they then decided that actually nuclear is great, it's good. How do you get an environmentalist to decide that a nuclear power station, which is going to produce all this waste, right, which you can't do anything with, massive, massive cost, and really the only benefit of it is to produce plutonium and enriched uranium for nuclear weapons, for the nuclear weapons industry, for the maniacs, right? How do you convince them? Anyway, he managed to do it through his Guardian column, and he was pretty impervious up there. And there were a whole bunch of other Greens who coined themselves Greens, who I would call them just green fascists, actually, fake environmentalists who are using the green agenda to, and that I think was a very important milestone. And this I think has, you know, spiraled now into the idea that a nuclear power station is a fantastic thing to have and a coal-fired power station is terrible. Well, they've proved through this absolute reliance on renewable energy that it's not resilient. You know, you get a difficult winter, the wind turbines freeze up, the solar, but they've got to have their nuclear power stations.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, you know, that we've seen, of course, there's another side to this, Richie, and that is that if we get a war in the Middle East, there ain't going to be no oil coming. There's going to be very, very little in the way of fossil fuels, apart from coal, maybe, available. So I think they're restructuring the energy industry to prepare for a possible war, but they're not telling us that.
A possible war, so the never-ending propaganda against Iran and Russia then playing a part in that. One of the reasons
getting rid of the cars as well, diesel cars, it's another part of the same agenda. And all they're doing, by the way, as I was driving through the Cotswolds half an hour ago, I was watching both sides of the roads. We're seeing loads and loads of trees have been chopped down. Now, I don't know what's happening here. This is supposedly a green agenda where people are paying loads of money to plant new trees. Well, hang on a minute. Where are all these trees going? And why are they all being cut down?
Yeah.
I've never seen it in my entire lifetime, my 50 years, where there have been operations right around Gloucestershire, around Bristol, Somerset, etc., where over the last year or so, you know, thousands and thousands of trees have just been taken from the roadside.
Why? Has anybody said why?
Well, they're going to, for wood pulp, for the good old green wood pulp industry. And remember that Planet of the Humans film last year that exposed that what's going on here is that the so-called green environmental movement is destroying our forests and destroying our green.
It's an inversion, isn't it? It's a complete inversion. It's turning logic on its head. A green agenda to chop down
and
pulp trees.
They can only
trees.
Get away with this with the complicity of the BBC, the mass media, and the Facebooks, etc. So that if people start calling it out for what it is, they get banned or they just get blacklisted.
Banned and blacklisted.
Like poor old David Bellamy did on BBC.
David Bellamy, famously, that's right. And this is why all the parties are in lockstep with the agenda. One of the reasons I draw that, not comparison, but why I link lockdown and this agenda is I think once in my broadcasting life did I ever get something right, and anybody could have gotten it right. I said that Epstein might kill himself, and he did. But I think last year I could see that they would look at lockdown and they would say lockdown is making the world more, it's making the air more breathable. It's making the environment cleaner. And it's helping with CO2 emissions. And I said very early on last year, it won't be long, Tony, that they will use lockdowns as a planet saver. Now, what I mean by that is, let me quickly qualify before you come back in. What I mean is, it might not be beyond the bounds of possibility that sometime in the next couple of years, we might get allocated driving time. Like, I'm living in Bristol, right? But I'm living across the road from UT. So they say, right, on Tony's side of the road, you get to take the car out at the weekends, 3 and 4, or 1 and 3. On Richie's side of the road, my side of the road, you get to take the car out on weekend 1 and weekend 3, or weekend 2 and weekend 4. I see that coming, I really do. What do you think? Why not?
1988, I had a briefing at the Department of Transport, Department of Transport as it was in those days, where they were talking about road pricing, and they were sounding out me as an individual journalist, the top officials at the DOT, on how are we going to introduce road pricing, because this is what we want to do. Now, they weren't explaining to me why they wanted to do it. They want the idea that if you can afford a car, then you can afford to pay a toll. They figured that one out. But they were not happy with just making people pay tolls. They wanted people to pay fees for driving everywhere and anywhere every day. So rather than paying for the fuel and paying for a car, they want an extra fee, an extra tax to go to the government. Now, this is just racketeering. So the idea that, you're not actually making money out of making a better widget or whatever it is you're building. You're not doing that. What you're doing is you're just taxing things that people need to do every day. You've destroyed public transport pretty much. I don't know if people enjoy using, actually London's pretty good, but in most places the buses are awful. Certainly in Bristol, the buses are horrendous. The taxi service is being decimated in Bristol. We've had half the blue cabs in Bristol, the Hackney cabs, destroyed over the last 5 years because of them allowing Uber in. Basically, the council has done some sort of backhand deal with the Uber. So we've got no proper public transport. So people have to have a car. But, oh, dear, you've got to pay extra. And this is what the government is turning into a for-profit racket company, not a government which is serving the people in any way. And so it doesn't really surprise me, you know, when people get tax for just going out of there. And you may well be right. The other thing is most cities have restricted the traffic. I mean, Bristol massively, but other cities too, over the COVID. And of course, now all the traffic's starting to return. They're gridlocked almost straight away. So they're saying, oh dear, we've got gridlock. We're going to have to introduce congestion charges. It's all rather transparent if you take a long view like I do.
Very good coverage, by the way. I follow you, obviously, on Twitter. And I recommend you do too, people. It's at Tony Gosling on Twitter. Follow him. Really good work on what's happened to the Hackney drivers there. That's a really big story. And you've done well on that. This is not meant to be flippant, glib, childish or silly. I don't see it as a ridiculous notion. The idea in the future, they'll ask us to wear a device that converts or traps the carbon dioxide we breathe out, Tony.
Oh, God. Well, yeah. I hope not. Hopefully there'll be a revolution before that point.
Yeah. Gee, I know it sounds stupid. Horrible. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But they've got people used to wearing face masks, which do absolutely nothing to prevent the transmission of any virus. Face masks even are worthless. Everybody knows this. There is no evidence to support them being efficacious or healthy for a starter. They're unhealthy things, but they've gotten people used to wearing them. They've gotten people used to walking around with a covering on their face, and people are happy to do it. How long before 4, 5, 6 years somebody says, hey, you can wear this on your face? Why? Well, it'll capture your CO2. I just wouldn't. I would put nothing past them.
Well, God knows, but I mean, certainly very dystopian, isn't it, all this? Look, I mean, can I say something about India?
Anything? Well, of course, I was going to come to India anyway. Do you believe the stories coming out of India?
I think it's important to understand what's been going on there.
Bodies in the streets.
Back in January, they introduced the vaccines, like we did here, but a little bit afterwards in January. But as part of that vaccine deal, they started to rein right back on the use of ivermectin, which had been the mainstay of their defence against COVID. Back through most of 2020. It's also one of the big centres in the world where ivermectin was being manufactured. I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with this. Is an antiviral drug, which was originally designed as an antiparasitic drug, but has very powerful antiviral qualities. Basically, it stops the viruses attaching to your cells and injecting and basically hijacking your cells to produce more viruses. So it's extremely useful. It doesn't matter what variant you got. And so the India stopped using it in January, started on their vaccine program. Literally last week, they reintroduced the use of ivermectin again because the situation over there was so disastrous, so terrible. And I think largely because of the censorship of everything about ivermectin, and I don't know if you've spoken to Dr. Tess Laurie, but her conference last weekend was absolutely brilliant. You know, they're really starting to make a very, very strong case, which is hopefully increasingly difficult for people like Sage, NerveTag, the cabinet, Matt Hancock.
Here's the problem, T. Here's the problem. Tess Laurie was on with me for 40, 45 minutes, did a brilliant job of explaining how she was able to analyse the drug and why she was convinced the drug was very, very, very good, very useful in treating this illness. Very good, obviously very credible woman, has done this for the World Health Organization. But she did tell me during that conversation, she sent all of the data to basically every politician in the country and to the government, and nothing. Silence. You could hear a pin drop.
Well, it's a criminal conspiracy. Of course, I hate to say it, but these people are there just to promote the vaccine, not to promote people's public health. And they're using the whole public health message as a con. They're also enormously exaggerating the threats. I mean, what was it? You know, hardly any deaths going on at all, even false positive deaths at the moment. So there is no excuse for all of the, you know, the lockdowns, etc. Interesting that Bill and Melinda Gates are getting divorced. I look, the first time I saw that, my immediate thought, right, is PR, right, is that most of people like this, many, many people in these super rich positions have got these kind of, you know, relationships which are, you know, convenience or whatever, financial convenience. And I'm not saying they don't love each other, they never have. But this looks to me like a PR job, you know, sympathy for, look, they're human, you know. So let's get talking about the, you know, the relationship between Bill and Melinda and how it's all been a bit of a difficult, so difficult for Bill. I reckon you'll probably find some of the same PR people that have been spinning for the vaccine are now spinning for the Gates Foundation around the world's press. And there is this organisation, which I came across someone very nicely shared with me the other week. I looked a bit into that quite deeply, which is all funded to do the whole of the UK media's PR work for COVID. So they're constantly on, you know, in touch with all of the science correspondents, all the news editors around the country, giving the same message to every news outlet. All paid for by the pharmaceutical industry.
Now, I'm going to ask you this. I know you won't agree with it. But rather silly for me to ask you something and then say you won't agree with it. No, I'm going to suggest this. And I'm not saying I believe this, but I'm open to the possibility. Maybe the vaccines are killing people in India. Why not?
Well, it's quite possible, isn't it? I mean, the reason, there's nothing particularly shocking about that. There shouldn't be to people. Right at the very start of this, with that excellent article on the Fort Russ website, which Robert Kennedy wrote about, the headline was The Messiah, was it Bill Gates' Twisted Messiah Complex? Terrific headline.
Yeah.
And that details the mass deaths that have been caused by these vaccines from the Gates Foundation over the years in the, we might call the third world, mainly Africa. We were covering the deaths caused by what wasn't actually a vaccine. It was people being injected deliberately with the AIDS virus. It wasn't even a vaccine. It was just that they didn't know what was in the injection. And this far right, you know, white supremacist group in Africa was over in Mozambique and other places injecting black people with AIDS because they wanted to kill black people. And it was supposed to be a vaccine program. So there's a whole history of not only deliberate uses of vaccine programs to, you know, basically for a eugenics agenda and a white supremacist or whatever agenda, but also that these are experiments on humans that they've been doing, but Gates has been doing, and they had large slices of the budget from Pfizer, for example, in their program. I think it was meningitis in Africa, where the money for the trial of the vaccine. At least half of that sum was to bribe officials and then to fight court cases if anyone managed to survive get the money to take them to court.
That's a fact.
So they're not really interested in anything, but we are going to trial this, and we don't care about the law. We don't care about the nation state. We don't care about the health of the people. We just want a few results. It's a little bit like a live trial of an atomic bomb, isn't it? You know, why would you try it out in the desert somewhere when you could try it on a city to see what its actual effect was? You know, if you really wanted to know what the effects were, why not do a live trial? And that's what Gates has been doing with these vaccines for decades.
And this isn't a vaccine. And I think a point that a lot of people are missing, you are not missing it. But I think
You're right, of course. Yeah.
The important thing is, for a number of years now, various NHS people have been saying that the country will move away from conventional treatments. In other words, treating illness when it pops up, and that they were going to move from treating illness when it popped up to a more preventative approach. And you and I talked about this some years ago, and alarm bells were ringing straight away. This is the idea that they will give you gene therapy drugs. And they've been talking about this openly for many years, right? Okay, we won't wait till you get, obese. We won't wait till you get diabetes. We won't wait until you develop a problem with your kidneys. We've got an injection that we can give you. And that will train your body to recognize the kidney infection in the future or to recognize the diabetes and so on. And I think that's what this is about, this whole COVID thing. Whatever the virus is, and you've done some brilliant work on the Far East and how it emerged, and I have great respect for that work. And I don't disagree with any of it. But for me, the whole thing now is about kind of cultivating an idea, planting a seed in people's minds. Get used to being offered things all the time that are good for you and good for society. And don't think about turning it down, T, because we can't have you coming to accident and emergency or blocking up a hospital bed because you turned down the diabetes vaccine. I think that's where it's all going.
Horrendous. You're right. It's an end to journalism. It's an end to investigative journalism. Yeah. It's an end to critical thinking. The idea is everyone has done your thinking for you, and you just do as you're told, because why would you not? You know, the idea is to get out of people's minds the idea that they might question stuff. Now, of course, there's still quite a few of us around that question everything even more because of that. And I think actually they're on a hiding to nothing doing it. But, you know, I've never actually been to China, but having quite a lot to do with the Chinese, including Chinese journalists, I can see quite clearly what's happened over there is that the people who are very pliable and will do as they're told are promoted. And they've got a society where this is looked up to. People who start questioning things end up, you know, sweeping the streets or sleeping on them, you know? So you've got a totally topsy-turvy society, and it seems that we're kind of copying that sort of thing over here too. And that's what bothers me most about this, is we're not being encouraged to think, and in fact, when we do start thinking, we're being censored. So the idea, you know, is quite obvious. It's rather the Martin Bormann quote, if I'm allowed to use that, Hitler's private secretary at the last few years of the Second World War. Every educated person is a future enemy. And they don't want people to be educated. They really don't want people to be thinking for themselves and talk critical thinking, because they know they'll see straight through these people who are now trying to run the show. Basically, a privatisation of government, as we've been seeing in Bristol over the years. The local government we pay council tax to, it does absolutely the minimum services, and it just treats it like their own little fiefdom, which they spend money on their mates. And that's where we are, I think, now, is that the government system is being, I mean, it's becoming fascistic.
Fascistic,
we were told,
yeah,
when we had a Bristol mayor back in 2012, we were told by the opposition at the time, well, if this goes through, we could end up with a dictatorship. We've got a dictatorship where, you know, the mayor, as the article that I mean, we've got the elections coming up on Thursday, the mayor, as I discovered from interviewing somebody, he fell out with some one of the local businessmen, or he had a disagreement with him. He got into a temper. He stalked off. And that guy can no longer rent property in the city, you know, off the city council, because the mayor doesn't like the cut of his jib. Now, this isn't democracy. This is a kind of Sheriff of Nottingham territory.
It's dreadful, isn't it? That's dreadful. I want to ask you that is absolutely dreadful. And we've spoken about this guy before, this Marvin guy. Let me ask you about this. Tony was great this morning. I asked Tony to come on today, and then I asked him to maybe hold off if I could get some comment on a big story that developed in the last few days in Ireland. And thanks to everybody who sent me a tweet asking me, am I covering the Pat Sweeney story? I'd love to cover it, and I hope to get some comment on it in the next day or two. I gave Tony a very kind of ham-fisted explanation. What happened was a week or so ago, the Irish Gardaí, the police force in Ireland, removed parishioners from a local church in Athlone, told them to get out, which is a tyrannical thing, of course, and Pat took a video of it. He didn't do anything else other than take a video of it, and, you know, why wouldn't he? It's what everybody should do. Well, Saturday morning at 3:30, so Friday night, Saturday morning, the Garda Síochána Conaire turned up to his house and removed his children from his care, from their father's care. There's a video of that which has gone viral online. It's horrendous. I understand the children were believed to have gone to foster care temporarily, but they're now back with their mother. And I tell you what, Tony, we don't do melodrama, you or me, or exaggeration. This is tyranny, this. This is the Irish Gardaí basically punishing a guy and warning people, you don't film us, you don't criticise us, we'll do whatever we want. You talk about the Sheriff of Nottingham, I've never seen anything like it. To punish a guy, to basically, what do we say, Tony, when whistleblowers, targeting whistleblowers, basically, in that manner, I've never seen anything like
okay,
it.
Okay, well, this is partly because I think we've got absolutely no checks and balances on the police anymore. I think, you know, the last one was having a decent chief constable at the Metropolitan Police, Robert Mark, who did everything he could to stop corruption. But even then, he had hundreds of officers he couldn't sack. There has been a brilliant series on BBC Two over the last few weeks called Bent Coppers, Crossing the Line of Duty, which has been explaining how it works, really. The idea of, I mean, one of the most incredible things in that, Richie, was where the police, all the detectives in the City of London and CID at Scotland Yard were all called into a briefing about scenes of how to do scenes of crime properly by one of the chief commanders. And it turned out, they were all scratching their heads, what are we doing here? We know all about this. And it turned out that they'd all been brought together to take them off the streets so that an armed robbery could take place with no police around.
Jesus.
And, you know, this is the sort of thing that's been going on. And I think it ever worse. Every 10 years we get a new group which oversees the police, supposedly, where you can complain to, and then they get discredited, so they have to make up a new name for it. There isn't any real checks and balances on these police forces, and we've seen the same sort of thing. You know, we've seen all sorts of police violence going on in Bristol where they just get away with it. There isn't any real accountability. Now, once you start going down that line, you know, obviously you've got yourself a Gestapo on your hands,
yeah.
you know, a police state, and I think that's a large part of what these COVID regulations have been brought in around Europe, particularly obviously in the States as well. It's where it gives the police carte blanche to decide every occasion on whatever they feel to do what they want. And I have seen some really positive stuff actually. One was, you know, if anyone was organising an event which they think might be closed downable by the police, go through the law. I know it's boring. The day before, pick out the clauses which allow you to do whatever it is you're doing, and just make sure you've got them on a clipboard to hand when the police turn up. Because I saw this happen with the police turn up with about five or six riot vans. The girl who was about to speak at this rally they were trying to close down showed them the regulations, and they all got on their vans apart from about five or six police and drove off.
How interesting. How interesting.
Because the law is, at the moment, it's an emotive thing. They can shut the stuff down. Now, of course, if they have to compensate people, well, they don't really care. It's not their money. It's public money they have to compensate people with. So I think, you know, to actually put them on the spot, actually at the time, is probably most probably the best way to go with the police.
Brilliant stuff, mate. Folks, thisweek.org.uk, the politics show Fridays with Tony Gosling. There's nothing like it. There isn't. Check him out if you haven't done before. It's at Tony Gosling on Twitter. We better move on and get Piers on to have a...
Well, just quickly, if I can say something quickly. On that show, it's very genuine, because Martin Summers, he's a Republican, Irish Republican, a Labour activist. He's pro-lockdown. So we have genuine Barneys week after week, which I think the listeners quite enjoy.
There's not too much of that, is there? There's not too much of that anymore, T, on radio in the UK. Brilliant.
No, that's right. And also, by the way, I've also just brought out, it's just out in paperback, my book about the Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergs. So that's just out. If people are interested in that, because there's a lot of research over the years that's gone into that, which is really, I think, about what we're living through now. Which
it's gripping, T. Hang on. It's gripping. Where can they get that book? We talked about this on a program not too long ago.
Well,
where can they
get it? The Bilderberg.org website has got all the links, and you can get an actual physical copy of it. But I spoke to you, didn't I, about the timeline through the end. And really, it's the end game of the Second World War. What really happened? The deals done between the Nazis and the Allies for all the technology, for the enriched uranium, you know, the people that they were going to give new identities to, because they already in 1944 decided that they were all going to get together and fight the Russians in the Cold War. Churchill wanted to nuke Moscow, for God's sake. You know, so I think it's been an interesting journey that, you know, digging out particularly Desmond Morton, who was Churchill's private secretary, and his role in it all. He was very close to King George VI. You know, so they were manipulating it from the start to make sure they could make as much money as possible out of World War II for the Fourth Reich.
Well, you make a brilliant case for it.
Empire.
You make a brilliant case for it. Bilderberg.org. Check out that book. Buy a copy of the book. Support journalism like Tony Gosling. Support journalists like Tony Gosling. Tony, I'll move on. We'll do this again, no doubt, in a couple of weeks' time. Always a pleasure. Thanks for your time, mate, as usual.
God bless, Richie. Take care.
You too. Tony Gosling there. Bilderberg.org for the book. Check it out. I recommend it. I haven't read it, but I recommend it. I know Tony. I've known Tony for years. We've got to get Piers Corbyn on in a couple of moments. Time, I'm running a bit late for that. Thanks for your tweets. Now, Jean Anne Crowley, I mention Jean Anne often. Great, great lady. Terrific journalist, as well as an actress. She's been following the Pat Sweeney story. Pat was able to get the children's mother over from Paris via Belfast. So the boys are with the mum. She was horribly distressed, no doubt about that. Jean Anne points out the Irish Gardaí want to make it illegal to film them. Of course they do, no doubt about that. And decent, ordinary people have rallied around Pat Sweeney and his family. And that's a good thing to hear. And this was tweeted to me in the last moment, and I did see something about this today. And it concerns Donegal, a beautiful part of the world, the far northwest of Ireland. Mr. K on Twitter says, Richie, it was also announced in Donegal, the Gardaí have introduced a phone-in line for the public to snitch on their neighbours for breaking COVID guidelines. That is true, by the way. This is where we are. It's not 1984. It's not Brave New World. Those texts, those great books, those historic books, they don't cut it anymore. This is beyond 1984. This is beyond Brave New World. Way beyond it now. We're way beyond that. We're way beyond the looking glass. The things that are going on and that they're getting away with. Piers Corbyn joins me in a moment. Before that, it's music from Queen. It's 6:04. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford, Europe's most listened to independent radio show. Back in 3 minutes. Right, that is or was Queen, and you're my best friend on the Richie Allen Radio Show. 6:06. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to the programme the physicist, the meteorologist, the one-time Labour councillor, and a candidate in this Thursday's London mayoral election. Lovely to welcome back to the programme, Piers Corbyn. Welcome back, Piers. How are you?
Well, I'm great. We're getting fantastic support around London. I mean, completely seriously, you know. It's working class and even middle class communities are backing us and saying so.
You're a logical man. Obviously, as a scientist, you're a man of logic. And I know you are getting great support. I know this because I get a lot of correspondence from people who say they've met you out and about. They're definitely going to give you a vote. There's no doubt about that. Realistically, what do you want to happen on Thursday? What would be a good result for you if we accept that it's going to be difficult, you know, to beat Khan or to beat, and I don't want to be negative here now, but look, we're logical people, or to beat the Tory. What would be the realistic, what's your best hope?
Well, my best hope is we can win. You see, I know it sounds astounding, but on the ground, the Labour stronghold areas, people are saying, and they're not people who've met me before, generally, they've heard about me maybe, and they see our policies, and they say they will back us. And I know also for a fact that a lot of Labour members are giving out our leaflets. And then they're not, you know, they don't care about Sadiq Khan. They're not promoting their own party. So, you know, the newspapers, I noticed the Evening Standard admits that the so-called poll lead, or, well, actually, I don't know if he's got a poll lead, but, you know, Khan is losing support. That's what they're saying.
I have no doubt.
Now,
well,
that is a fact, and where's that support going? Well, it's going to us. It's not going to Tories, because people who've had lockdowns aren't in favour of Tories, because the Tories imposed them anyway.
None of the main political parties have offered so much as a sliver of resistance to this lockdown, so they haven't. None of them.
No, none of them. And you see, our policies are very clear. And, you know, in just in terms of the voting, I mean, I've been astounded at the level of support we've got, right? Now, obviously, candidates are always optimistic people, but, you know, it is definitely there. If our vote, you know, our support turns out, we will win. I mean, I know that sounds maybe far-fetched, but we will. The people who are, like, pro-lockdown or so forth, are actually, I think, less determined to vote. You know what I mean? They're not going to do much about it. So it'll be a low poll and,
a low turnout, you think?
Yeah.
You think a low turnout. And you think those that are for lockdowns or maybe lukewarm support for lockdowns might not be inspired on Thursday to go out and to cast their vote. Maybe not.
No.
I admire the optimism and I wouldn't knock it.
We have people who are, you know, going along with various things the government's done and go along with wearing masks, sort of. But they're voting for us. I mean, not all of them, obviously, but a lot of them are. I mean, when you meet people, if they're not wearing masks, they're pretty likely to be voting for us.
Yeah.
But the ones who are wearing masks are also can see now, increasingly, that there's something wrong. And therefore, the lockdowns have to end. And we are the clearest exponents of ending lockdowns, along with other policies which are very important for Londoners. For example, well, I'll tell you our top five policies, you see. It's no lockdowns and no masking and ending the COVID rules. And I can do that by telling the police not to implement the government's guidelines, that's their legal status, on COVID rules. Second thing is, I'm saying that we will have to talk with the NHS and demand or campaign or fight to make the NHS stop leaving people with serious illnesses behind, like cancer patients dying because they're excluded because of the COVID rules. Third thing is we would stop the ultra-low emission zone extension to the North and South Circular Roads. Now, a lot of your listeners wonder, what is that? Well, it's the rules whereby people with not new cars have to pay more to drive around.
Yeah.
And that means a lot of businesses will go bust. And they're already in difficulties. And you see the huge expansion of this area means it's going to have a devastating effect on a lot of London. But it also means people who are driving to avoid this extended zone will go greater distances along the North and South Circular Roads. So that will cause actually more pollution because there's more fuel used to get to any place. And the third, or the fourth thing rather, is our housing policies, for example, which are very forceful, whereby we can build 400,000 more homes, or get 400,000 more homes in the life of a mayorship, largely by converting commercial properties into housing. And already the City of London has started actually doing this.
Which type of commercial properties now, Piers? Which type of commercial properties are you talking?
There's a lot of empty commercial office properties. Not all commercial properties are suitable, obviously, and some of them should be converted in my watch to use by for youth centres and so on. But we could end homelessness within the term. And the next most important point is no to various testings and passports which you have to have for jabs and so on, which are, I think, you know, completely unacceptable, and it's a medical apartheid thing.
What do you think about the likelihood? We're still waiting for Michael Gove to report on his what did he do? He went to report, and he was sent to report on how a vaccine passport system would work. And we understood that. We understood that initially they were going to say, okay, we might need these for overseas travel, whether we like it or not. But of course, the really interesting thing is what they might recommend domestically. Are you convinced that, I mean, it's a stupid question maybe, that they're obviously going to come back, aren't they, and say that they would prefer that we use these vaccine passports as they're doing in Israel, namely to go to hotels, to gyms, to theatres. I don't know when Gove is due to report back. It was supposed to be a week or so ago. Maybe they're a bit worried about the timing of it. Maybe they think it's not the right time to do it. But there's no doubt they want to do this, right? This is their plan.
Yes. Well, I think on this sort of passporting, there's actually two things going on. One is, it's part of the general ideological brainwashing, and it's to give the public contagion fear, to remind them all the time there's this dangerous COVID thing and they've got to do what they're told. So the vax passport is largely a mental thing. You see, the threat of it is all they need to then, because then people start complying getting the jab anyway, and so on, in case the passport gets imposed. So it's a self-imposition. But it's also part of, I would say, a kind of general move for all sorts of testing, you know. So they want to have more and more testing and control of anything that people might have, and which I think is all part of the whole orchestra of control, which the new normal and new world order want. They want control and compliance.
You mentioned earlier on something very interesting. You mentioned that Labour members have been handing out your leaflets. I have no doubt that's true. That's kind of positive, that. You look at Labour at the moment, you have Keir Starmer, I would argue, possibly the worst leader in the history of the Labour Party, at least as long as I've been alive. Forget Blair. Blair goes without saying. Blair was a maniacal, mass murdering madman. Forget Blair. So that's positive that you know that there is still some resistance in the Labour Party, at least amongst the rank and file. Anyway,
absolutely. A lot of these people were supporters of my brother. You know, I mean, I know some of them, and it's very clear they said, oh, well, Piers, we've been campaigning for your brother and now we'll campaign for you. And, you know, that we've got councillors that have stood up and ex-councillors. Councillor Omar Ahmed in Manchester, who came down specially to speak at a rally to say urges everyone to support me. Now, he might be expelled for this. Who knows? And other people who were campaigning for my brother are also sticking their necks out. And, you know, with that sort of base, it means we can win. I mean, I know it's astounding, but obviously it's, the way is, you know, that they've got a pretty biased voting system, but you have to get you know, the first two candidates who got enough first preferences can, one of those is going to win in the end. So it's important that I get as many first preferences as possible. That's the aim.
You're listening to Piers Corbyn. Piers is a physicist. He's a meteorologist and a former Labour councillor. You know all about Piers, and the Weather Action website. Known him for years talking about climate change, the hoax that is climate change and many other issues. Piers is standing on a number of platforms and he's just outlined the policies that he would implement if he was to win the election on Thursday. But primarily, I suppose, it's anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine passports. I put an article on my website today.
Yep.
It seems to me there's a big issue here. It's a bit late to do anything about it now, but we've got to look at it in the near future. That Twitter, ironically today, the Iranian government is being accused of trying to interfere in a Scottish election on Thursday. It's the most preposterous and ridiculous story I've ever read, Piers, right?
Why?
It's mental. Exactly why. And you know what? On the same day, Twitter is banning people who have paid their deposit and have put their names on a ballot, whether it be in London like yourself or whether it be in Manchester. Now, if that isn't election interference, I don't know what is. It's incredible.
Yeah, no.
They've done it to you.
This election, is the amount of interference by mainstream media into the democratic process is astounding. All right. The BBC have completely ignored our campaign. In fact, they've really just got the traditional political parties there and pretending the rest don't exist. Even though we're doing extremely well, they just pretend there's nothing going on. The Evening Standard today carries an article, a two-page spread here. It says, violent crime crisis dents the Khan political lead. We've just days to go. And then it's got a headline, Bailey, Berry, Fox or Count Biniface. So you see, they remove us completely and put a ridiculous candidate as a possibility. And they've got a list of some of 10 candidates, so they left out half the candidates, including me, in their list. Now, that is unbelievable. Now, I don't know who it was who said there's one thing worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about. You see, and I think the mainstream media and politicians have realised that when they arrest me or attack me, it backfires on them, because we normally have things to say, and they have to report them because they're in response to things they've said. So now they've decided to give a total blank to us, which of course is a sign of our strength. But the only way we can overcome that is by leafleting at doorsteps and alternative media.
Well, it's funny you say...
All power to all the alternative media.
Absolutely. It's funny you say this now, because while we rage against the BBC's refusal to cover the fact that several hundred thousand people gathered in London, why we get pissed off about that, I bet you that if you went around all the various YouTube channels and channels on BitChute and channels on other brand new tube, whatever, it almost makes it inconsequential that the BBC doesn't cover it. Because if you add up all the views around the alternative, you're talking millions of views. This message is getting out there. Like you said, when they've arrested you wrongfully, treated you badly, you know, people have been there to film this. This has gone, as we say, it's gone viral. So for the moment, you know, it doesn't seem to matter that they refuse to cover it at the moment. I mean, it might become more difficult to get things on social media in the future. I wanted to ask you this. We've got Piers Corbyn on. Piers is running for London Mayor this coming Thursday. And all the best to him on Thursday as well. I wanted to ask you this. I know you've been speaking to people over the years, recent years. I mean, I think the first time I saw you was I was in London in 2013. And I think you may have come into TPV to talk about something with somebody, but it wasn't with me. Could have been with Mark or somebody like that.
Yeah.
So I knew at that stage.
I've been on there a couple of times. Yeah.
That's right. You came in a couple of times. So I knew that this guy Piers Corbyn, who's well known as a meteorologist, and he's well known because his brother was a Labour MP at the time. I remember thinking, this guy's clued in. You've known for some years, haven't you, that the Orwellian I shouldn't say Orwellian, it's beyond Orwellian. This dystopian nightmare that's unfolding in front of our eyes. You've been alive to that for more years than many people understand. It's not a recent thing for you.
No, that is very true. I mean, it basically started unfolding in 1992 with the Earth Summit at Rio. And interestingly, when you look back, you can see lots of social policies changed in the wake of that. And one thing I noticed was, obviously two things. The climate nonsense story that man is responsible for changes of climate, and therefore CO2 is bad, and therefore that's an anti-industrialization project. Okay, and the second thing is, though, the regeneration of working class areas. Because this phrase regeneration suddenly popped up. Then when Tony Blair was elected in 1997, he went to the estate near me, the Aylesbury Estate, as it's called, Elephant and Castle area, Walworth area, and said, oh, yes, the people here can have what they want. However, when they had a vote on it, the people voted against what Tony Blair wanted them to want. So, you know, the struggle goes on. But these regeneration programs sound nice, but all of them are about destruction of working class community strength. And you see, this is all central to the new normal and the new world order. They have to destroy trade union strength, working class community strength, and in fact all strengths of collectively people or even individual rights in order to get a compliant population, which is controlled.
They were very clever with language, weren't they, over the years? You've talked about this many times. Because as you just said, these when these are presented to people, they sound and look so benign. And they look so benevolent. Yeah. How could you argue with some of these terms? You know, regeneration, it sounds lovely. But ultimately, when you look into it, and I know you went around the country with Sandy Adams and Mark Windows, and you did some fantastic talks where you explained to people in brilliant detail, in a way that they could understand, you know, this is what these projects mean. They do mean the destruction of your way of life. And it's coming at the speed of light. People have to kind of wise up to it, you know. Here's a question for you, Piers, and put you on the spot now. How much of these agendas do you think people like Tony Blair understood, or is Blair just a stupid frontman who'll do anything for a buck and really doesn't understand that he's still, I'm not trying to give him a pass now, but that he wouldn't see the bigger picture. You know, you have seen the bigger picture. You understand where it goes. But is Blair just a guy who would just do anything and say anything if the price is right, not knowing what the agenda really is? What do you think?
No, I think he's smarter than that.
He knows.
Well, after I was a Labour campaign organiser in the 97 election, and I met Tony Blair after that because I was deemed to be one of the best voluntary organisers in the country. And then I have to say, I didn't think of him as being, because it was only 98 or so I met him.
Yeah, he was only enough.
He seemed like just, you know, sort of progressive whatever. But likely, I would say, beneath it, there was always this intention a New World Order intention, you see, which was born out. In fact, I didn't fully understand what was going on then. Just starting off on day one on the Aylesbury Estate, for example, where they wanted a demolition program. Because subsequent Labour governments under Gordon Brown, when the tenants voted against the demolition, David Miliband came along as Minister of something to reverse the democratic process and said knock it down. Now, there's been much to and fro and resistance and confusion with the housing associations involved that it's still three quarters there, the buildings. But it would seem to me that actually Blair's general intentions were there all the time. We just didn't realise them. And I don't think he's just a front man. No, I think he's a key player.
He's darker. He's deeper into it maybe than people like me think. No, it's great to get that point of view. I would have thought previously the player, like everybody else that ends up in Downing Street, is compromised at some stage along his journey, you know, compromised with money or compromised with, you know, he's induced into taking part in a financially illegal transaction maybe, or something even more sinister. That's how I thought they got these guys to do their bidding. I'm not sure that's untrue, but I'm willing to concede you know more than I do. And Blair, yeah, I mean, I'm going to go along with you. I look at Blair now going on television and, you know, advocating for tyrannical vaccine passports, advocating for vaccinating children, Piers. Both of us know that whatever coronavirus is, it doesn't touch children. They do not need to be vaccinated. So Blair is a special case maybe, yeah.
Yes, that's right. And on this issue of immunity and so on, of course, Michael Yeadon, you know, formerly of the
Glaxo, I think you worked for
the camp. GlaxoSmithKline. He says that once you've had one of these COVID-like or any sort of flu things, then your immune system overcomes it, and that makes you immune to all the similar strains of this thing. So the idea of a mutant suddenly coming to attack everybody is just a nonsense. It won't attack, but it can't attack people who've already had it.
Yeah.
And children themselves, of course, are not... Well, they're developing their immune systems. So vaccinating them is going to cause harm because these jabs reduce the immunity of children or anybody who gets them, and the consequence of that is that other diseases can spread. So that is what will happen. So the danger I think the population has isn't from people who haven't been jabbed, it's from people who have been jabbed, because that is going to open the door to other illnesses. And that happened after Bill Gates' experiments in India and Africa had been done, and it showed that girls were dying at 10 times the rate if they'd been jabbed than if they hadn't been jabbed.
If they hadn't been.
So, you know, it's a clear damage to the immune system.
I'm not going to waste my time and your time by arguing the point of view of the government or of the sage scientists. I'm not going to do that. And I'll tell you why. Right. I'm not going to insult the intelligence of our listeners. Our listeners know that these are not vaccines. These are therapeutic drugs. They admit as much. They say that these vaccines will not prevent you getting coronavirus, but by taking one, it reduces the risk of you having a serious infection. So this is nonsense. This is their own claim. This is the words from their own mouths. It won't stop you getting it, but if you have the vaccine, it will mean that when you get coronavirus, your symptoms won't be so bad. It's horse shit, Piers, is what it is.
I've been
a journalist long enough. This is nonsense. Why would you? I'd rather take my risk and my chances with the virus, thanks. You know,
I mean, the figures of injury and death and illness arising from what's been going on is astounding. Now, if I'd been saying, well, we have been saying people should take ivermectin or chloroquine and zinc to overcome these sort of symptoms of these types of flu. If anybody had died from taking ivermectin, I'm sure the newspapers would be outside my office.
Of course they would.
Accusing me of death. But there's hundreds, I mean, I haven't got the figures in front of me right now, but, you know, 600 deaths, I think, and thousands of illnesses, as a consequence of having these jabs.
We know by the yellow card reporting system, don't we?
We do. It's the yellow card. I've got it. 847 death toll and 626,000 reactions is the total from 9th of December to the 15th of April.
I will be the devil's advocate here. I will be the devil's advocate. How can we be sure that the 847 died as a direct result of having the vaccine when the yellow card reporting system is anecdotal in nature? So how do we know that 850, 900 people have died from the vaccine? Why do we believe that?
Well, it's a strange coincidence to have these sort of numbers, and they are people who reported this, or their families reported it, that they believed it was from the vaccine. You see, well, I've got an example of a case, a friend of a friend who reported on, you know, this had happened. He said somebody received the jab, and 2 days later they died from a brain hemorrhage, a blood clot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked him, did he want to say anything to some alternative or other media that was around? And
he didn't want.
He burst into tears. He couldn't cope.
And I don't blame him. And no. I interviewed a lovely couple recently who believed that their father and father-in-law, mm-hmm. Colin Wise, Colin was 91 and incredibly healthy, still looking after himself at home. And anyway, they gave him without the family knowing, they gave him the AstraZeneca jab one. And within days, the man was in a desperate situation in hospital. He clung on for weeks and eventually died. His son, Alan, came on with me, and Caroline, his daughter-in-law, Colin Wise, and they're convinced the vaccine played a part in his death. I'll tell you something funny about that case. Not funny, I don't mean funny, but something sniffy about it. When they wrote up the death certificate, they left out the fact that he had a clot on his lung. And and when the coroner or the person registering the death rang up the family said, why did you leave out the clot? Without missing a beat, the registrar person said, I'll put it on. So they knew the clot was central to Colin passing away, and the clot might very well have come from the AstraZeneca vaccine. So it's you just don't know. I know you've had probably countless letters, have you, Piers, or texts, or did they give up on asking you to come and have the jab? They must have given up pretty quick, did they?
Well, yes, I've seen another letter from the NHS today, which I admit I haven't yet opened, but I'm sure that's what it's about.
Yeah.
Well, you see, we now have a coercion regime. The NHS has been stolen from us, and it is a coercive, dictatorial operation, like the worst of tyranny under Hitler or Stalin. I mean, that is the way it's going, and it is really worrying. And at the same time as these things, we've got a big upsurge in propaganda of all forms to try and coerce or brainwash people into subordination. And all these reports of India.
Well, I was just going to bring, can I just ask the question before you give us. No, don't be apologizing. I'm interrupting. I shouldn't be interrupting. But because I was bringing it on to India, I was going to make the point.
Okay.
I was going to make the point that your opponents would say, Piers is living in cloud cuckoo land. Things might be lovely at the moment. Lockdown has driven down cases and deaths. That's what they would say. And they would say, look at India. Look at India as to why we need to be careful. A variant in that country is causing a catastrophic amount of deaths and illnesses. That's what they would say. What do you think is going on in India?
Well, it's a fake operation. We have people campaigning with us largely in the Sikh and Punjabi community, but others too, who say that it is a fake thing. Well, what is happening there? We have a massive united campaign of Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, everybody, against the attempted takeover of the land by the Indian government and the mega corporations. In partly to subjugate the Indian population, of course, they will exaggerate any deaths and claim that this or that is caused by COVID. But for us, these stories are to subordinate us and make people scared that this might happen here. Now, you look, the two countries where these biggest crises have happened are Brazil and India, and both of them have very reactionary regimes, very much pro New World Order. And we know in the case of Brazil, a lot of that was exposed as being false, and that is the same as is happening in India, where people we work with have just pointed out there's been fake photographs, exaggerated stories, and so forth. And, of course, reportage in a manner which confuses people on the West, because bear in mind that India is a vast population. So large numbers of people dead, if anything, is much less significant.
You mentioned Brazil. Hang on. You mentioned Brazil. You mentioned Brazil.
Yes, I did.
My understanding of Brazil is that Bolsonaro has been very much anti-lockdown. And I know there's an inquiry into his handling of the pandemic there. There's a Brazilian Senate inquiry. So I know why you're saying that it's pro New World Order, but Bolsonaro has kind of been Brazil's Trump, hasn't he? And he's wanted to open up.
I think it's obviously complicated, but the story that's coming out is been somebody out there has been promoting, exaggerating the deaths of all sorts of so-called COVID in order to. Promote a certain agenda. No, what I said is an oversimplification, I would say, of the details there. But the that country has been used like that in the same way as India.
Yeah, he's really against the deforestation of the Amazon, Bolsonaro.
Yes.
Many of the things that he would claim to be in favour of, we would agree with. But I understand where you're coming from. Ultimately, the things they're claiming about Brazil, we're not going to get to a BBC presenter is not going to interview Bolsonaro.
No.
They're not going to interview him on Sky News. So it's the same with India. I know there is opposition in India to the claims being made. I had an Indian listener phoned the program last week from just outside Delhi, and she said to me that it's wildly exaggerated, the claims being made about Delhi.
Yeah.
And she's no reason to say that. Unless she believes it, but this is the ultimate result of what has happened to the media being concentrated in the hands of only a few corporations. They get to tell us these stories about India, and we don't get access to people, or easy access anyway, who say, well, hang on a second, this is just rubbish. This is not my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
But they want us to believe that people are dropping dead on the streets in parts of New Delhi. And, I don't know what to believe. To be honest with you, I know what I suspect, but I don't know what to believe. Piers Corbyn is our guest, friend of the programme. Mm-hmm. We've known Piers a long time. He's standing for Mayor of London this coming Thursday. And busy old time for him now in the next couple of days. Of course, with the lockdown nonsense, Piers, hustings and debates have been difficult. Have you managed to... I mentioned this when I interviewed David Curtin last week. Have you managed to do any of that? Have you managed to take part in any debates or have your say online?
No. We did invite all candidates to come along to Hyde Park Speaker's Corner and have a debate. And, they didn't show up. I mean, we had some communications, but they didn't show up. Green Party said they were too busy doing stuff. David Curtin did come to some other thing we had in Hyde Park, and we had a bit of a discussion. The woman who wants the community councils, as she calls them, or something like that, she came along, but that was, again, was to a different event when we went to the BBC to demand a fair hearing. So no, we haven't got those things off the ground, although we've attempted. There is meant to be something on alternative media happening on Wednesday evening, which we've certainly agreed to take part in, but I don't know if other candidates
have or
not.
If any of the others will get involved.
But I know for certain that Sadiq Khan and the Tories won't turn up to these things, because the last thing they want and the last thing the BBC wants is debate. As mayor, I would insist on proper balanced debate on everything. For elections, you've got to have proper open hustings, and the COVID situation is used as a cover to not have those things. On any debates about health or pollution, whether or not exclusion zones for vehicles work or not, you know, those things, we would have proper scientific debate with both sides represented. And we would demand the BBC has both sides represented. I mean, the different sides of debates on jabs and vaxes would have to be represented in such discussions, and we would say the BBC ought to report them.
It seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? It seems like a long, long time ago that you could depend on a programme to offer both sides of any debate, you know, an opportunity. Yeah. I was listening to, it must have been talk radio briefly this morning. I listened to all of them. I flick around between them. And Mike Graham had John Lee, the former pathologist, on, and he was saying, you know, the thing he finds most difficult to understand is how the media has been able to ostracize academics from some of the country's most reputable universities. You know, people like Carl Hennigan and others, how they've basically been cast to one side, even though they have earned the right, as you've earned the right as an academic, to have an opinion. It's the sage scientists all the time telling us lockdown, lockdown, more lockdown masks. And you've got all of these other people who've earned their stripes, who've got their degrees and their PhDs, and they're not given so much as 2 minutes or 3 minutes. I do believe that Sunetra Gupta might have been on BBC News 24 with Anita McVeigh the other morning. But with the greatest respect to Sunetra Gupta, I imagine she's a brilliant woman. And I imagine she's got a brilliant mind as a scientist. She's not the best communicator in the world, God love her. And, I don't want to be offending anybody by saying that. But that's an astonishing thing. It was a given when I started in radio as a producer that if you brought somebody on, you know, to say that, you know, we need to lock people down to save the elderly, it was an absolute given that you would find another scientist who says, that's bollocks, don't do that. And you would do it. You would have a proper debate. That's gone, Piers. That's completely
gone. No, absolutely. Now, the thing that the current powers that be fear most from me, there's two things. One is I would be committed to action to resist and stop the New World Order. And that means standing up to the government by saying the police have to follow what we say and not implement Boris Johnson's rules, would cause... call all such of legal challenges on the NHS. They've got to implement the Nuremberg Code and therefore have no coercion of people into taking anything. And those who have been implementing coercion should be arrested, and that would mean that Matt Hancock should be arrested, for example. So I would be doing things which would challenge the impositions upon us and not just comply with whatever limit the government set, because the only way we're going to break the New World Order is by actually breaking the rules being imposed. So that's the first thing.
That's important, civil disobedience. Fighting. Civil disobedience, right?
Because absolutely everything. People on the ground would be supporting what I'm doing and vice versa. And the second thing is I would be bringing scientific debate into things. So we'd make a scientific discussion of actual data, actual measurements by scientists, central to decision making. Now, these things, of course, go together. Accountability and science go together. And we can win with these. We can make a better world. But the New World Order sort of scenario, if you think about it, they know that science and tyranny are incompatible. And that was shown in Germany before the war, and in Stalinist Russia, where, you see, if you have scientific debate, you've got to have openness and so forth. Well, if you don't want scientific debate, you've got to suppress openness. So, you know, Hitler wanted to impose the idea of the master race, and Stalin wanted to impose various ideas about inheritance of acquired characteristics. So, you know, if people had said one thing in the Russian Academy of Sciences that Stalin didn't agree with, they wouldn't be there at the next meeting. So, you know, the suppression of scientific debate necessitates tyranny, and they completely go together. So people have to realize that the, you know, where we're heading is actually an anti-scientific world, run by a, well, completely unacceptable.
A centralised dictatorship.
Tyranny, yes. Yeah. A centralised dictatorship.
Do you believe that people like Carl Hennigan know more than they're letting on? I hear Carl Hennigan on talk radio. I've invited him on this programme. He turned me down. I know why. I know why other people have come on the programme and they've been hammered in the mainstream media for coming on.
Yeah.
You know,
yes,
so he sees that and he says, oh, if I go on with Richie Allen, I'll be in the Daily Mail or I'll be in the Guardian because Richie interviewed some guy, some anti-Semitic guy 2 years ago or 3 years ago. It's bollocks. It doesn't matter. But I wonder, these guys, they must know more. I mean, if you're Carl Hennigan, he's like yourself, he's educated. He's university degree educated. He cannot know at this stage in his life, he cannot believe, surely he can't believe that this is just bad management. This is bad policy. He's got to be thinking deeper than that, Piers. He must.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think a lot of them do know what the agenda is and either go along with it or don't go along with it. But they do know and it helps them to pretend not to know.
And maybe he thinks he's doing as best as he can. Maybe he thinks, you know, I've got bills. I've got bills to pay. I might have a big mortgage. You know, if I go the Piers Corbyn route and just tell the truth, balls and all, as you do, to your credit, he might think, well, if I do that, I could be in serious trouble.
Well, you know, that is true. No, I've got friends who said at meetings, you know, off the record, Piers, you might well be right. This was on climate matters.
Yeah.
But I've got a mortgage to pay.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have compromised. Now, because I'm working independently, have an independent company of my own which sells some forecasts, even though I spent a lot of time doing this type of campaigning for the election, you know, it still is that I can't be pushed around by, you know, the likes of the Royal Society or anybody who doesn't like my views.
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage.
Or doesn't like my scientific results and wants me to essentially suppress the truth, what I know to be true, just by, you know, what we've understood and studied about solar activity.
You've been doing it for years too. It's not a recent thing. If I was in London, even though I've not cast a vote in an election proper since 2002, I did vote. I haven't. No, I did vote in 2016. I voted yes to leaving the European Union. I voted to leave the European Union. I did it for the crack, really. I didn't think for a minute we'd win, but I did it. But no, I've not voted for a candidate because I've believed, and I know we could argue about it, but I think we're on kind of the same wavelength. I believe that the system has been rigged for years and that whoever you vote for, whichever party, I don't mean your brother now, I don't mean an individual, but whichever party is in power, ultimately, two sides of the same coin, and the globalists that we talk about, the financiers, they control everything. So I've not done that. But if I was in London on Thursday, I don't know, how does it work? Are you allowed to vote your first preference and then give a second preference?
Yeah.
A third preference.
For the mayor, you put a first preference, which is what we must have for me, and you can put a second preference for mayor. Then you have another ballot for your local candidate.
Yeah.
And there we have there's 14 different areas of London, and we have some Let London Live candidates.
Good.
And the third thing is there's a London-wide list, which you just cast your votes for these party list, and then the percentages will enable numbers of people
proportional representation. It's a system we have in
sort of
sort of. It's not exactly, you're quite right, it's not exactly the same. I suppose you would hope then that people who give their number one to Piers would give their number two to somebody like David Curtin or another.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
David.
Of course, of course. And, that'd be fine, you know.
And I'm sure he would say that anybody who gives him a number one would give you a number two. I didn't ask him, and I'm not asking you either, so I shouldn't put you on the spot either. But
all I'm saying is we need the number one.
You need the number ones, yeah, of course you do. Look, mate, I wish you the best on Thursday. I hope you're right. Miracles do happen from time to time, you know. And, you're getting the feel on the ground, as you said earlier on. You're meeting plenty of people who've had enough of this nonsense and who want to back somebody who would try and bring an end to it. So all I can say is I wish you the very best. If there's anything you want to say before we wrap things up, anything you think you might have forgotten to say, now's the time to do it. And like I said, I wish you all the best on Thursday.
Thank you very much indeed, Richie, because your support is welcome all the time over the years. Yes, I would say that we do have the policies and determination that can roll back the New World Order. And the example this will give around the country and even the world will be tremendous. So getting me elected there and us standing up on day one, telling the police what to do, launching legal challenges against the NHS, bringing in new housing policies, defending free speech, I mean, you know, such as rights of assembly and travel, we'd be supporting Julian Assange. You know, we'd have an international dimension of what we're doing. We would also end some of these little crazy policies around London of road closures all over the place, which are damaging to business, and give local people power over these things, like have little groups who want to set themselves up, like let Walworth live, let Camden live, or whatever, where they can decide what is right or wrong about these modifications. And our general thrust about the NHS, and again, through pressure from the mayor, we could campaign to get wellness as a priority before the interests of the big pharmaceutical companies. And the government would have to compensate all people who've died or injured from having the vaccine, and all those who coerced or misled people into taking the vaccine would be culpable. And that means, I'm quite serious, that we would be talking about the arrest of Matt Hancock, and I would be saying to the Metropolitan Police, look, you have to implement civil policing and stop this harassment of the public, or especially businesses, just because of the COVID thing. So, you know, in summary, the two words to end on would be, I would be standing for action to stop the New World Order and make London and even the world a better place. And secondly, I'd bring scientific debate into the political sphere, where it has been very sadly lacking over the last 5 decades.
Yeah, no doubt. And the website is still stopnewnormal.net, is that right?
Well, that is very good, but the best one to go to would be letlondonlive.org.
Letlondonlive.org.
The campaign itself. But they are completely connected, yes.
Brilliant. All the best on Thursday. We'll be watching it closely, Piers, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much indeed, Richie.
You're okay. Welcome. All the best for Thursday. Piers Corbyn, folks. Letlondonlive.org. Letlondonlive.org. That's the website. A million thanks to Piers for coming on today. Hey, listen, before I go, some bad news from Spiro Skouras. Now, you'll know that I have a lot of time for Spiro. I regard him highly. He's a journalist with great integrity. And he's had a YouTube channel for some years that has become very popular because he uploads interviews with men and women on any number of issues you care to think of. And they're brilliantly constructed interviews. He's very fair. And as long as I've known him, he doesn't go to air with a claim or a comment unless he can validate it. He's old school, Spiro. He applies journalistic principles to everything he does. And I think he's had nearly 100,000 subscribers, if not more, on his YouTube channel. But he's just sent me a depressing message. It's been deleted, basically. Google has deleted his YouTube channel for so-called community strikes, okay? They've deemed that some of his content is unacceptable for one reason or another, and they've deleted his channel. It's dreadful stuff, this. It's happening to people all the time, day by day. And activistpost.com is where you'll find Spiro Skouras at the moment. He'll be on this program again soon discussing these matters, of course, lockdown and other matters.